Good morning, everyone. It's Wednesday, March 2nd, and you've joined us for National Security This Week. We get together here on KYMN Radio every Wednesday at 9 a.m. to discuss national security, and we're joined by guests from our local area, from around Minnesota, and often from across the nation to help us explore American national security. I'm your host for the next hour, and my name is John Olson. This show covers all aspects of national security. You've often heard me talk about the tools of national power, those tools being diplomacy, the power of information, sharing that information, military power, and certainly economic power. And how those tools are used is referred to as statecraft, which should, I think, be thought of as both an art and a science used at the same time. Nations apply statecraft in various ways, sometimes concentrating on the hard power aspects like military power. We're seeing that play out right now between Russia and Ukraine, but also economic sanctions and those kinds of things. We're going to talk a little bit more about those issues today. Other times, nations may practice soft power, the sharing of information or diplomatic engagement toward achieving common goals in economics, the rule of law, or humanitarian issues. One aspect of diplomacy that is not well understood but serves a vital role in America's engagement with the world is something referred to as public diplomacy. And we're going to take a deep dive into public diplomacy today with a very experienced diplomat. Margo Squire served as a career diplomat for 30 years with both the U.S. Information Agency and the U.S. Department of State. She completed assignments in Munich, Moscow, Melbourne, Baku, Ankara, Kabul, and Washington. Margo Squire has extensive experience in public affairs, media relations, educational exchanges, management of U.S. government assistance activities, and even U.S. policy on nonproliferation of weapons of mass destruction. Highlights of Margo Squire's career include service as Director of Democratic Initiatives in the State Department's Office of Coordination for Assistance to the New Independent States, where she managed U.S. government-supported democracy programs throughout the countries of the former Soviet Union, including those related to the rule of law, policing, civil society, elections, and free media. Again, we're tapping into Margo Squire's experience today on current events. We'll have a lot more to talk about there. She was also a director of press and public outreach for the state's Bureau of European and Eurasian Affairs, supporting the press work of 54 U.S. embassies and developing communication strategies for major events across the region, including the U.S. response to the color revolutions in Ukraine and Georgia. As director of the Policy Leadership Division of the Foreign Service Institute's Leadership and Management School, she managed and led senior-level training involving multiple agencies and emerging issues such as cybersecurity, conflict resolution, and peacebuilding. As director of the Office of Strategic Communications and Outreach of the State Department's Bureau of International Security and Nonproliferation, she spearheaded efforts to build public support for U.S.-led multilateral efforts to remove chemical weapons from Syria and the Arms Trade Treaty, a U.N. treaty covering international weapons transfers. Margo Squire earned a Bachelor of Arts from Dartmouth College and a Master of Arts from Johns Hopkins School of Advanced International Studies. She retired from the State Department but returned in 2021 to serve in the American Embassy in Kabul for 11 months, supporting 27 educational centers that provided both Afghan men and women across the country access to the outside world and opportunity to support change in their local communities. She currently works as a consultant in international affairs, speaking with groups on U.S. foreign policy and international affairs. She develops and leads tours at three museums in Minneapolis, as a matter of fact, the Museum of Russian Art, the Minneapolis Institute of Art, and the Weissman Art Museum. And she is an election officer for the state of Wisconsin. Margo Squire, welcome to National Security This Week.
Thank you very much, John. It's a pleasure to be here.
So we're on Zoom, you and I are. Are you at home right now in Wisconsin?
I am. I'm on overlooking the lovely St. Croix River. I can see Afton across the way from me. I'm just outside of Minneapolis.
Okay. All right. So, Margo, I like to start my discussions with my guests to learn a little bit more about their professional backgrounds and whatnot. My hope is that there are parents and grandparents listening to this show who might turn their grandkids or children onto the idea of public service, national service, service in the national security arena as a diplomat or something else. Could you start your discussion? Let's start the talk today. Tell us about your path into USAID and the Department of State.
Well, actually, you know, you hear of people who are third, fourth, fifth generation military families. Well, I'm a third generation U.S. Foreign Service family. My grandfather was started serving for the U.S. Agriculture Department and then Commerce Foreign Commercial Service after World War I. And my father in the 1950s worked for the State Department. So I actually grew up overseas. I was very interested in other cultures, what it meant to be American as I would transfer back and forth. And so I think for me, it was a logical progression to go into the U.S. Information Agency and the State Department to represent the United States and continue that service overseas to our country, to our foreign policy.
And what was your favorite assignment during your career?
It's always hard to say because, you know, every country is different and also every part of your life is different. One of my favorites was serving in Australia. We had young children. It was a wonderful place. But in terms of professional, I'd have to say it was my first overseas assignment to Moscow, where I was for 4 years. It was the Soviet Union. I got there after Chernobyl. For me, working in public affairs, to see the Soviet Union actually openly start talking about this horrible accident that had happened was an amazing thing. And I think that what I really appreciated was that I was there for the 4 years that the Soviet Union was opening up before it fell apart under Gorbachev. And I was working with journalists who were starting to be journalists, you know, actually asking questions. When I first arrived, 90% of the journalists I worked with were the New York Times and Western journalists, and the Soviet and Russian journalists were afraid to even talk to us. And by the end, it had flipped totally, and they were acting as journalists. And I think that that's what I really started getting my appreciation for, the power of the press and what journalists do to serve people and as an interface between government and the people.
Yeah, the vital nature of the fourth estate, right? Keeping government in check in support of freedom and democracy. So let's get into our core topic today. There's so much to discuss, and I really want to make sure I take advantage of your expertise today. Let's talk about that core topic, public diplomacy. You've had extensive experience in many facets of diplomacy throughout your career. I think it might help our listeners if we start this discussion to understand a little bit more about what a U.S. Embassy country team is. We can set that as a foundation for our discussion today. What is a country team in the U.S. Embassy? Who serves on that country team? And why does the organizational structure of that country team matter?
Well, in a way, if you think about, you know, if you look at an embassy as being like a U.S. company, so you have a CEO, you have, you know, a chief financial officer, you have administrative people, you have HR, you have public relations people. So you've got all of these people. What a U.S. embassy is, you know, it's like little America overseas. And it has, you know, primarily the State Department, but then it also has, can have up to dozens of other agencies. So the FBI, you can have Department of Justice, you have the U.S. Agency for International Development, you have the Foreign Commercial Service that's working on our trade and business. So the country team is headed by an ambassador, and he is the direct representative of the president. Ambassadors have to go through, you know, a vetting process, and they are confirmed by the U.S. Senate. Then under the ambassador, the country team has top representatives of all of these other sections within an embassy. So from the people that are running the embassy in management, the people in consular who are helping Americans that are in distress, which is the number one priority of an embassy, to, as I said, the FBI, which is out there to protect and also investigate when terrible things happen to Americans after terrorism or murders or whatever, and public relations, where I worked, public diplomacy.
So in your experience, I mean, I know the numbers have been growing, but there's a difference between a political appointee ambassador and somebody who's a career diplomat being assigned as U.S. ambassador. Can you talk a little bit about those differences? I have some other follow-up questions about the country team structure as well.
Sure. I mean, yeah, so embassies around the world are headed by an ambassador that's either comes from within, you know, the core, usually the State Department, has gone up from, you know, early beginnings through a career, gets to a certain point, and then is nominated by the White House, confirmed by the Senate. At the same time, there are a number of posts around the world that are where there are people that are nominated by the White House because they, for all sorts of different reasons, they may have a connection to that country. They may have contributed to political campaigns, and they also go through this confirmation process. So any given embassy, you will have one or the other. And, you know, it's something like 90% of embassies in Western Europe are headed by career, by professionals. 90% of embassies in Africa are headed by career.
Okay.
So that already tells you something.
Yeah, that's true. So I served almost 3 years at the U.S. Embassy in Helsinki, Finland, under two different administrations, George W. Bush and then the first administration of Barack Obama. And we had two different political appointee ambassadors there. Neither one of them had ever spent time in diplomatic circles and whatnot, but they both turned out to be phenomenally gifted, talented leaders of the U.S. Embassy country team. And then the deputy chief of mission is invariably a career diplomat. Is that correct?
Yes, absolutely. That's usually because they have to actually, you know, really oversee the running of the embassy and the conduct and the relationships. So, yeah, that's usually definitely a career person.
And so when there isn't an ambassador assigned, they also serve as the chargé d'affaires, right? The deputy chief.
That's correct. And we have over the course of the last few months, we've had a lot of chargés because the nomination process and the confirmation process for ambassadors was held up in the Senate. And so people like my husband, who was a career ambassador, were then asked to go back, as he was to Afghanistan, for example, mm-hmm. to serve as chargé acting ambassador until an ambassador could be nominated, confirmed.
Yeah. And I'll just remind our audience that that your husband is Ross Wilson, and Ambassador Wilson was on the show with us a few weeks back, actually a couple months back now, talking about what happened, what transpired as we withdrew from Afghanistan, which was a truly fascinating show. For our audience, you're listening to KYMN Radio, AM 1080 and FM 95.1, and we're broadcasting out of Northfield, Minnesota. This is National Security This Week, and I'm your host, John Olson. Our guest today is retired Foreign Service Officer Margo Squire, and we're discussing public diplomacy and its importance to American national security. So, Margo, you clearly have the intro sort of explained it all. You have a very strong background in various aspects of public affairs. We're going to talk about public diplomacy, but it might be helpful for the audience to understand what public diplomacy is not, before we talk about what it actually is. What is not in the purview of public diplomacy and the duties and missions executed by U.S. embassy country teams at embassies abroad?
Right. So public diplomacy officers basically articulate policy. They don't form it. So while they may be, you know, through experience and outreach, gaining information, which they can feed in to either Washington or the country team, they're not like the political officers, the economic officers, carrying out, you know, government to government relationships, working on trade treaties and civilization agreements so that our planes can land in Rome or Paris or wherever in the world. So that the day-to-day operations of and conduct of what we think of as traditional diplomacy in between governments, we're not involved in. Likewise, we're not negotiating on behalf of U.S. companies or helping U.S. companies that are in trouble. That's going to be someone in the commercial section. We're not day-to-day helping Americans who've lost their passports or have ended up in prison or in hospitals. You know, those are going to be American Citizen Services officers in the consular section. And we're not giving visas or vetting people that are coming from another country to go to the United States. So we're trying to explain and clarify what U.S. policy is, yeah, and our relationships.
So there's clearly, I think most people probably don't know this, but there are so many things that happen from a U.S. country team at a U.S. embassy abroad to support American interests with the host nation, wherever that may be. And there's some really interesting aspects of how we communicate that role and the role of the United States with the citizens of those countries. So maybe you could talk a little bit about what public diplomacy actually is. I mean, how is it executed? What are you trying to accomplish through public diplomacy?
So public diplomacy is really unlike traditional diplomacy, as you can tell from the name. It's reaching out to foreign publics. So it's everything from supporting people-to-people exchanges to explaining to citizens of other countries, U.S. positions, what the U.S. is. This really came out of post-World War II experience when it was clear, before the war, the U.S. was pretty isolated. We really didn't want to be that involved with the rest of the world. We were still pretty much growing within ourselves. But we found that meant that we were cut off and that we couldn't explain, what we stood for. So things like international radios, those were sort of the first ways that we started talking to countries of the world, particularly as the Soviet Union and in Eastern Europe were being closed off. We created things like the Voice of America to explain and give information to people who were not getting information from the outside world. There were surrogate radios, Radio Free Europe and Radio Liberty, that were set up and supported by the U.S. government, with nationals of those countries speaking in their own languages to the people, acting as if they were a free radio within those countries. The BBC at the same time was also broadcasting. We also started citizen exchanges. Senator Fulbright had studied in the UK, and he saw the benefit of these relationships that come when you are actually living in another country and working and studying with people. So the exchange, the educational exchange that bears his name, the Fulbright Exchange, was started in 1946 to bring Americans overseas and to bring others from around the world to the United States. And there's a quote that I love that he said, which is that educational exchange can turn nations into people.
Yeah, that's a good
and
point. That's
humanize and humanize international relations.
Yeah.
Because, governments are not very good usually at talking to other governments or governments talking to people. Whereas people can talk to people, particularly across professions. Teachers, understand and have the same issues whether you're in Hong Kong or you're in New Orleans. There are a lot of issues that just cross borders that people can circumnavigate. And I think that was the most important thing, to open up the world to each other.
And so, Margaret, you've traveled all over the world. I've been fortunate enough to do the same. I'm sure a lot of our listeners have also had the opportunity to travel around the world. And I think one of the things that we find as individual citizens, when we speak with people from other countries in their nations, you always hear, oh, we love Americans. We love Americans. They may be opposed to American government actions, but they love Americans. And so that's sort of an example of public diplomacy at work, when we as individual citizens travel abroad, have an opportunity to have one-on-one engagements with citizens from other countries, and we humanize the human condition by speaking with each other and building those friendships. Is that an accurate assessment, Margaret?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And one story that I love is when I was working in Washington in the office that coordinated the democracy assistance that we were giving to the former Soviet Union, we found that these citizen exchanges were some of the most cost-effective ways. And a new program was started called the Future Leaders Exchange, which brought high school students from around the former Soviet Union to the United States, living in American homes, going to American schools, volunteering in the community. And so every year a group would come to Washington, and I just remember these students, I would meet with them And they would go and they would visit members of Congress, and they would, you know, to sort of try to build more support for the program, but also just to show who they were. And I remember, you know, this one young, passionate man from a young man from young boy from Kazakhstan who is telling me, well, you know, today I got to see my congressman, and I told him, and I'm thinking, wait a minute, you're from but you're talking about your congressman from Indiana, you know? And it was just like, you know, they're people of two states. They can understand us when they go back to Kazakhstan. Yeah. And meanwhile, they've touched this whole community and school in the United States. And so it's just, you know, it opened up the world to their countries and their needs. That just blew my mind.
It reminds me of the importance of a program like the Rotary Youth Exchange Program, which happens all across the U.S. and around the world. A fantastically important program, frankly, for this.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
So we know that everything today is connected via the World Wide Web. I mean, literally everything. You know, social media has taken over so many aspects of our lives and influences us in so many ways. Profound impact on the news cycle, frankly. What can you tell us about the ways public diplomacy has changed even during the course of your career and, frankly, continues to change with advances in technology and how we're able to communicate things to people all around the world?
Yeah. Oh gosh, this is going to date me. When I started in Moscow, we literally got the news from ticker tape machines. So if you see an old movie, and you'll see these things, and they make a lot of noise, and they're literally taping, you know, typing out the words, and it was called the wireless file because it came by wireless radio, and so you would get these stories and, you know, cut them off, and then you would share them, distribute them to your contacts with, like, this is what's happening here, and this is the official, you know, report of our president, you know, his latest speech, and here's what he says about your country or whatever. And fast forward to personal computers, and then, well, first of all, CNN, actually, in 24-hour news, yeah. And then personal computers, and then and laptops, and now cell phones.
Right.
The iPhone has just revolutionized communications across the world.
Yeah.
And obviously the internet. So where in the past we might pick up the phone, now a lot is being done over, you know, Facebook and Facebook Live exchanges with, you know, the whole world, or YouTube and Instagram. And, you know, if we look at how this war is being raged in Ukraine right now, it's, you know, it's kind of a war of TikTok.
Right.
Citizens on the ground are taking videos and they're showing real time, you know, the buildup of forces, the 40 miles of, you know, tanks and heavy munitions that are heading towards Kyiv, mm-hmm. and interviews with people on the streets and at the barricades, and pictures of destruction in cities, and people, you know, 30 degree weather in a shelter, underground shelter. I mean, it's this has completely changed how and revolutionized how people deal with people around the world.
Yeah, and I definitely want to dive in more to this whole Russia, Belarus, and Ukraine situation. But let me finish out a couple more questions with you. You mentioned the power of the cell phone, right? The modern day cell phone and the connectivity that we have across all these social networks and everything else. I would just highlight for the audience, much like Margo, you mentioned the wireless connection that you had when you first got to the embassy in Moscow. We used to use these teletype machines would be how we communicated in the United States Navy at sea. And you'd have these teleprinters that would print off the messages, and it would take forever. And it's this big, long roll of yellow paper that you'd have to replace constantly, and you'd have to read off the individual message. And you couldn't really make copies of it because there really weren't copy machines at sea and whatnot. And that all changed with the advent of modern technology. The purview of the capacity to communicate information on a global scale used to reside solely with national governments. And now you as an individual can actually communicate your ideas on a global basis instantaneously using the power of the cell phone and the internet. It's just an amazing revolution in information, the ability to move information around the world. I have to think that from a public diplomacy perspective, the complexity of the world's media outlets, availability for so many different communications paths to reach people, that for public diplomacy, for the Department of State, it's so much to try and keep track of right now for our professionals around the world in the Department of State. Can you comment a little bit about that?
Oh, it's absolutely true. I mean, I have to say that probably one of the key ways that we communicated with ourselves within the embassy and with others outside the embassy was through WhatsApp, which is an app that's on your cell phone. And you can send, you know, pictures and videos and texts instantaneously. So a story that someone once told me, you know, when a diplomat, an American diplomat, is going to another country, they go to the Foreign Service Institute and they study the language. Mm-hmm. And traditionally, it was very much like how you would study a language at a university here. You know, there are books. There are language labs, and you put on, you know, your headphones, and you tried to speak and follow all of that. Well, after Tahrir Square and the Arab Spring, where people were communicating by their cell phones and WhatsApp and these messaging, and Twitter was really the key thing at that point. Mm-hmm. The Foreign Service Institute realized that they were not even teaching people how to write or read or, you know, really use the Arabic language until, you know, like 6 months, a year down the way. And they realized this, and they didn't know, like, who to follow, you know. Yeah. Like, how do you decide, you know, who is real and who is not and who can be trusted? So they had to throw out the curriculum and start anew from day one using texts on cell phones. Now think about that. New language, Arabic, which has, you know, different alphabet, and you have to start doing that, and you have to, and also from week one, you have to start following people on Twitter and social media, because otherwise you're not going to know what's going on.
Right.
And so that sort of revolutionized the way diplomacy and diplomats were being taught.
Wow. So let me ask you this, because I think the way I have always understood it is that, you know, the public diplomacy, the public affairs, public relations that we do in the United States, we do our very, very best to deliver actual truth when we speak to other countries and peoples of other countries. How do you make sure you don't cross that boundary line between delivering truth and delivering kind of state-sponsored propaganda, like we see a lot of countries, that's all they have is propaganda? How do we make sure we keep that firewall up?
That's a really good question, because, you know, when I first started in diplomacy, I joined a separate agency. It was not the State Department. It was called the U.S. Information Agency. And one of the things that we prided ourselves on was that we were telling the whole truth, and we wanted to show the United States warts and all.
Yeah.
So in other words, the truth, but the good and the bad, you mm-hmm. know, like what's going on in the United States in terms of, you know, the continuing civil rights questions, mm-hmm. You know, to show, don't just, you know, gloss over, you know, events, but actually talk about George Floyd, talk about what the debate that's going in the United States, because that's more useful instead of saying, you know, everything is perfect here and just, you should just follow the way we are. No, we're struggling. We're trying to figure out how to get, you know, how to improve. It's a process, and you know, should be doing the same overseas, you know. So that was really important. And one of the things that we worried about was being folded into the State Department. We would lose that, and we mm-hmm. would become the propaganda, you know, arm of the U.S. government. And actually, one of the things that's really important is the legislation that set up the work that we do, whether it's the Voice of America or these citizens exchanges, set up a firewall. Because, you know, coming out of World War II, they saw the Japanese and particularly the Germans had this whole government propaganda thing mm-hmm. Directed at Germany as much as the rest of the country. A firewall was set up so that we could not direct this power on the United States. So that if we were going to be talking to the rest of the world, It couldn't be an organization that could be then taken over by a demagogue and used against the American people. And it's why the American people to this day don't even know about really about public diplomacy and what we're doing.
Yeah.
You know, Voice of America was very hard to even get in the United States, and that was for a good purpose.
Right.
So I think we're in some ways we're back to that point of warts and all. You know, showing the United States in all lights, because you know no country is perfect, and we all have our problems, but we're trying to solve them, and we can solve them together, and you know maybe working together across borders and nations.
I like to think that that's the purpose of a democratic form of government, that we work hard at democracy because it isn't easy. It doesn't come cheap and free. You have to work at it.
Well, and if I could add, that's why public diplomacy has gotten even more important.
Yeah.
Because citizens around the world have so much more say in their governments.
Yeah.
You know, even in autocratic states, you know, Russia, Belarus, you see the people that are taking to the streets that are protesting. They know what's going on in Ukraine.
Right.
And they're not going to be silent.
So let's go ahead and talk about the role that public diplomacy plays in actual real-world events. And we have it playing out right in front of us right now all over the TV and the radio with the Russian invasion of Ukraine. It's been in the news cycle now for for seven straight days. I mean, it's 24/7 news cycle that we're dealing with now. How has the United... Well, let me ask you this first. We talked a little bit before we got on the air today about the fact that most professionals, national security professionals, have watched Russia practice this sort of disinformation, misinformation campaigns, you know, their own version of delivering what is truth to the world, and frankly, internally to Russia as well. And trying to execute that with this whole run-up to the invasion of Ukraine, they didn't do a very good job of that this time. And frankly, they were countered by not only the United States, but all of our allies calling them out on this misinformation and disinformation campaigns in sort of a public diplomacy aspect to a certain extent. Can you talk a little bit about what you saw transpire on both the Russian side and on the kind of the NATO alliance side for this whole information war that's been going on?
Yeah, to me, it's been fascinating to watch because, you know, with this awful war buildup and then actual war in Ukraine, you know, the Russians have kind of stuck to their usual playbook. You know, they have said, you know, they've announced we're having these exercises and, you know, it's kind of like, you know, ignore the fact that we have, you know, hundreds of thousands of more troops and munition than we have ever had in exercises before. And they're all building up, you know, through Belarus on the north and then on the east. And then we've got warships, you know, going into the Black Sea. No, there's nothing to see here.
Right.
And also, they've stuck to their, you know, repeating the same thing over kind of over and over again. Putin has gotten in front of the Russian people and given these speeches, and you know, and told sort of, you know, increasing lies about what, you know, the why he's there, what he's trying to do. You know, he's been backed up by people like the foreign minister, Sergei Lavrov. But the fact is that, you know, all of these, you know, all of the things that they've been saying that haven't been true, like the fact that they're there, there's been genocide against the people in Donetsk. And so they're there to protect them. And now we're going to have to, you know, and also that the Ukrainians are torturing, you know, citizens in that part of the country. So Russia has to protect these people. It's not worked.
No.
To the extent that they've been able to in the past. You know, they're using an old playbook that they used first, you know, in Crimea. They've used it many, many other times. And also, you know, sort of this barrage of false information. You know, I spoke with you about how after the Malaysian aircraft was downed by separatists in the east of Ukraine, and then, you know, the Russians and everyone with munitions from Russia, and the Russians and everyone said, oh no, you know, this was not downed by us, this was the Ukrainians. They blamed the Dutch The majority of people on the plane were Dutch, going off to the Far East. You know, they're trying to wreck relations with Russia. But the thing is, all of these various things added to a huge, big lie that then people didn't really know what to believe. Mm-hmm. Well, that didn't work here because, first of all, early on, this administration decided to share, intelligence, which I've never seen before.
Me neither.
So
it's amazing.
I'm glad to hear you say that. Yeah. Coming from the U.S. military, aerial footage of the buildup of all, this huge buildup of munitions and people, and then along with the UK, calling the Russians out on disinformation, and also even going a step further to say, we know there are these plots, we know there are these individuals already in the eastern part of Ukraine who are going to create provocations so that the Russians can move in and say that, the Ukrainians are attacking the freedom-loving people of the East. And so it was like step by step, they were able to counter this, the disinformation and the lies, and have kept on doing that.
And in some cases got ahead of the Russians yes. on their disinformation, which was really impressive.
That was amazing. And sharing, almost real time, clearly intelligence has come out. I've never seen that because, first of all, the intelligence agencies were never willing to share information like that because they're afraid of the sources. But also, some of my struggles over my career were trying to get just even a little bit of information that I could share from, the Central Intelligence Agency or others about things that are, journalists were desperate to find out about. So you've got the West just, breaking through those and showing the lies for what they are.
Yeah.
The Russians not really being able to figure out how to get beyond that. You've got the Ukrainians, who I think are the real masters.
Oh.
President Zelensky in Kiev, with his impassioned pleas and his resolve and his, remaining in Ukraine. One of the things he said when, reportedly the U.S. government offered to get him out, fly right. him out, was, I need ammunition, not a ride.
Right.
And then calling on Ukrainians around the world to come back. The Ukrainian Minister of Defense on the street with the troops. I can't imagine the Russian Minister of Defense out there. And these guys they're young and they're, personable and they show resolve. And then the Ukrainian people, again, with their phones and their TikToks and, standing up to, Russian invaders is just, that has been a real feat. I think that the Ukrainians more than all. And one last thing about Zelensky, from all accounts, his personal appeal to the EU actually created a breakthrough where they were willing to all work together to crack down on the SWIFT financial transactions network. Really impressive, really impressive.
Yep. Briefly, for our audience, you're listening to KYMN Radio, AM 1080 and FM 95.1. This is National Security This Week, and I'm your host, John Olson. Our guest today is retired Foreign Service Officer Margo Squire, and we're discussing public diplomacy and the role it plays in American national security. So, Margo, let's continue on with this theme, talking about Russia, Belarus, Ukraine. We mentioned earlier the country teams. There has been an ordered departure of the U.S. Embassy personnel out of Minsk, and I'm sure there's a bit of ordered departure out of Kyiv. You mentioned before we got on the air that we've moved the embassy to Lviv. Is that right? Can you talk a little bit about what it means when we do an ordered departure of the country team?
Sure. There are two. They're basically it's an evacuation of embassy personnel. So, for example, you have various stages. You have and priorities. You have an authorized departure where people can voluntarily choose to go. So, our embassy in Moscow, for example, had officially designated an authorized departure of non-emergency people and dependents. So that meant basically people who are working in the embassy who are not in what's considered crucial jobs that need to be maintained can voluntarily leave. That's an authorized departure. So after, for example, COVID-19, was shutting down the world, embassies around the world had authorized departures, which said that people could voluntarily choose to leave and go home, where the situation wasn't as bad as in a number of countries around the world. On the other hand, you have an ordered departure, and that's where people are literally, as it says, ordered to leave. And it's usually a lot of times on a case-by-case basis, you know, who does the embassy, you know, who is absolutely necessary in the embassy? I mean, speaking from personal experience, having been in Afghanistan through this last year until the end of July, we went through three different order departures while I was there. First in April, an initial group of people were asked to leave, and these were people who were, or jobs, not people, but the jobs were designated as being, you know, less vital to the embassy, because it was seen, you know, the country, we might need to evacuate the whole embassy at some point. We need to start cutting down. So in April 1st, and then there was another step in the beginning of July, and then I was in the third order departure at the end of July, the 29th okay. of July.
So as we're pulling our embassy personnel, the country teams, out of a place like Minsk in Belarus, for instance, that order departure essentially means we're shutting down U.S. diplomatic presence in Belarus. Is that
correct? Correct. And if you go to the embassy website, it'll act in Belarus, in Minsk, Belarus, it'll say they have suspended operations. So the embassy is closed and ordered the departure of non-emergency employee and ordered departure. So that's mandatorily they are ordered to leave. Whereas in Moscow, they're on an authorized departure,
okay,
where it's voluntary and people can leave.
So when we remove our country team out of a place like Minsk, Belarus, all of the traditional roles that diplomats can play, we lose that capacity. How does public diplomacy then step in to maybe replace that in some ways to continue to further American diplomatic efforts towards peace and security in different regions? Like, let's take a look at Belarus, for instance. How do we communicate
right.
with the people of Belarus without a diplomatic presence
right.
on the ground?
Well, you know, through the World Wide Web, you know, our embassy, you know, Facebook and social media accounts will continue. They may continue from offshore, but those will continue. I mean, you and I were talking earlier about the Global Engagement Center. You know, there's a center in Washington, D.C. that is involved in coordinating efforts to, you know, certain parts of the world that are deemed really important, particularly to get our views across to, because we're not necessarily on the ground. And initially, this was to, you know, people in Syria, where we closed our embassy, and to counter disinformation coming from those countries. Mm-hmm. And I haven't been following it recently in the last few days, but I'm sure that the Global Engagement Center is right now engaged with countering, you know, disinformation that's coming from Russia, and also, you know, amplifying the messages that we and our allies are trying to make to these people. What we're doing, how our resolve, so they know that they're not alone, that, you know, this is what the U.S. is doing. These are the sanctions we're taking in conjunction with the EU and other European countries and other countries around the world, like Japan and Australia, that are not part of the EU, but are part of this whole global effort.
Yeah, it has been an extraordinary thing to watch, to see how fast the liberal democracies of the world have coalesced around cutting off Russia from assets that allow them to prosecute this war, isolating them in every way possible. It is incredible to see how fast the democracies have moved on this. And what role do you think public diplomacy has played in getting the people of those nations, not just the political leaders, but the people as well, to back their political leaders in clamping down so hard on the Russians in such a short period of time.
Yeah, first of all, I have to say that I am amazed to see how fast, you know, these all of this has come together. And I can only assume that President Putin in Russia and others are also amazed and never imagined, you know, like let alone in our own country. I mean, I look at the fact that, you know, President Biden had the State of the Union last night. And he started out in the first, you know, 10, 15 minutes were on Ukraine, mm-hmm. you know, and showed that resolve to the American people. And I've seen, you know, there was a poll this morning where people were supporting that. I mean, that is an amazing public diplomacy. You know, it's not foreign publics, it's our own public to explain what's going on and how, you know, this is a country that has, you know, traditions like ours. Many Americans have roots in Ukraine. Right. You know, there are a lot of Ukrainian Americans, and so people know, you know, Ukrainian Americans, and they can see, you know, what's happening, and they see shots of what's going on. So public diplomacy, I think, has played a huge role in shoring up resolve around the world and getting publics to support their governments, and if anything, push their governments to do more. You know, if anyone had told me that Switzerland was going to crack down on Russian bank accounts and, you know, an oligarch billionaire's accounts, and that Germany would close off the Nord Stream 2 pipeline when they depend on something like, you know, 40% of their energy needs coming from Russia.
Yeah.
Is just amazing. So, you know, all of these steps have I think really have come about because the world is so wired. Mm-hmm. And, you know, what you do in Kiev has reverberations in Tokyo and Sydney and New York.
So you're a career diplomat, and you're familiar with this area of the world, having served in Moscow as your first posting, and other things that you did during your career as the Soviet Union collapsed and some of those countries gained their own independence and started creating their own independent governments and whatnot. What role do you see for public diplomacy here in bringing this crisis to an end? How might it be used by the United States and even our allies around the world in bringing an end to this conflict in Ukraine? Any ideas?
Well, I think the first thing is that we need to see, this unity that we're seeing, you know, whether it's within the United States, whether it's within, within Europe, which remember just recently was splitting up and going its own ways. I mean, we saw the French president, Italian businessmen and others meeting with Putin, and it looked like they were going different ways and they were kind of, you know, not united. And now, so this new resolve that we're seeing has to hold. And I think public diplomacy has a role in keeping that strong and in pointing out, you know, what's happening, keeping the spotlight on actually what's happening in Ukraine, and pressure on diplomacy, you know, so that there were real talks, not, you know, whatever is happening on the Belarusian-Ukrainian border, where the Russians sent their cultural representative. in a time of war, do you send your cultural minister? So public diplomacy to try to amplify what people are saying around the world and what the Ukrainians, you know, show what's happening, and show the demonstrations in Belarus or in St. Petersburg and Omsk and all over the country and all over the world. That's what we need to do. And we need to, you know, have, real conversations between citizens in all of these countries. Find ways to help support the protesters that are in Russia, who are willing to go out, you know, in the freezing cold rain and snow and be attacked and, you know, brutally beaten and dragged off to prison, you know, as well as the protests that are happening in, you know, across the Stone Arch Bridge here in Minneapolis. You know, show the Ukrainians that, that the world supports them, and also keep the world's spotlight on what's happening. So I think public diplomacy has a huge role in getting the word out and getting the word back into Ukraine and other countries.
Yeah. So, Margaret, we're starting to close in on the end of our show for today, sadly. Man, could you tell us a little bit, tell our listeners a little bit more about the Department of State and the role of public diplomacy in State's mission? Maybe talk a little bit about the people that you worked with during your career at State. I mean, how committed are they to this, to the mission of diplomacy through this public diplomacy piece of what covers the diplomatic spectrum?
Oh, I just have to say that it's a, you know, it's a wonderful career. You know, it's not for everyone. You know, diplomacy, when I was in 10th grade, I was asked, you know, a lot, the whole class was asked to say, what do you want to, you know, what do you want people to say about you, you know, 50, 60 years from now? And I remember I wrote that I made a difference. And, you know, and other people had very concrete things. They wanted to make money. They wanted to cure cancer. They wanted, I mean, they had specific things. And I thought, oh, mine is so lame. But I realized that it's not. It's like, you know, you, people join the military. People join the Foreign Service because you want to serve.
Right.
You know, or you join the police force or you become a teacher. You're serving others.
Yeah.
And foreign diplomacy is a way to serve your country across borders, you know, overseas. You spend over half your time in other countries. So if you like people and you you love that, that communication and you want a further understanding between people, you need people on the ground who are listening to others, who are talking with others. And public diplomacy is great because you you interact with everyone, you know, people and academics and economists and professors and common man and government officials. I mean, it's across the board. It's not just one area. And if you're, especially if you're interested in reaching out through, you know, or use social media, it's, I think it's even better. I am not because I'm on the older spectrum. But, you know, it's a wonderful career. And I've definitely enjoyed it. My husband and I both have and raised two children overseas who are citizens of the world.
Yeah.
And I think that that's something that, that's really important. And it's so I would very much encourage people to you know, look into the Foreign Service, go to the website, www.state.gov/careers. And take a look because there are there's a spectrum of different things you can do and be a diplomat. Public diplomacy is one, and it's been the one that I have enjoyed the most because of dealing with people.
Do you want to tell us a little bit about what's happening at the museums and whatnot that where you, you give tours? I'll give you that opportunity.
We'll
finish off on a very positive note.
So most museums are not, you know, giving public tours yet.
Okay.
They're because of COVID there, but there are a lot of very interesting virtual tours, and I would definitely encourage that. There's a great exhibition at the Minneapolis Institute of Art that just opened called Supernatural America, which is it's about, you know, the role of, well, actually, you know, the supernatural and you know, the other worlds, maybe beyond ours, and it, how they've worked through art. There's a great exhibition at the Weissman that just started, building on the Minnesota tradition of adoptions of children from around the world, and that's a very interesting look. It's pictures. It's built on the pictures that families get when they're adopting a child from overseas. It's the first view, the first personal thing, you know, that you get to think, this is what the child that I'm going to have. And it's based around that, that very emotional, which is really important because to me, it underlines the people to people the personal basis of what I'm interested in, you know, reaching out to other people and cultural relations and international relations.
Yeah. So retired Foreign Service Officer Margot Squire, thank you so much for joining us today on National Security This Week.
Thank you very much, John. It was a pleasure.
Just very last question. Any publications or articles that you would recommend people take a look at to learn a little bit more about the concept of public diplomacy?
Sure. First of all, there's an organization called the Advisory Commission on Public Diplomacy. Advisory Commission on Public Diplomacy that can tell you all about, you know, sort of public diplomacy. It's been around since the 40s, and latest thinking and articles and about how it's changing. I'd say read anything by Joseph Nye, professor and academician who talks about soft power and the role of, you know, again, what I think of as citizen diplomacy in creating humanizing of foreign policy.
Yeah. Margot Squires, thank you so much.
Thank you, John.
Have a great finish to your week. Hey, that closes this week's edition of National Security This Week. We're on KYMN Radio, AM 1080 and FM 95.1. I'm your host, John Olson. Thank you for joining us today. Look forward to sharing time with you again next Wednesday morning at 9 a.m. Thank you for listening to National Security This Week here on KYMN Radio. Have a great finish to your week, everybody. Take care.
Margo, thank you. That was great.
You're on
mute on your end.
Was that okay?
Yep, that was great.
Good. Thank you.
I have Rich Larson, the news director for KYMN Radio, in running the booth for me today. And Rich was an international relations or political science poli-sci major. So he loves this radio show. And I was watching his facial reactions, listening to everything you were saying during our discussions today. And he's like, wow. So we had an impact.
Good. All right. Well, thank you very much and have a great rest of your day.
All right.
Thank you so much.
Bye-bye.